archiving and broadcasting, I am going to bring Jen in. Okay, so here we go. And so I'm on this call. Let's see if I can add Jen to this call. Add people. Charleston. Okay, so here we go. See if this works.
All right.
Hello.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing? We are officially on DS106 Radio, and that means we're in your ballywick. You know more about what we're doing right now than we do. So go easy on us. A little thing about this class, Jen, because you're probably like, why the hell are these people bothering me from Virginia about my skills? I have work to do. So A, thank you for being with us. But B, we teach a class at the University of Mary Washington called Digital Storytelling, which has kind of taken on a life of its own. It's a kind of open online class, but we teach 50 students at Mary Washington. And then there's potentially anywhere from another 50 to 500 out on the web doing various things and experimenting. So we heard from Kristen Capolice, who you are a good friend of, I imagine, that, and I know through Cole, and she said, you know what? I know someone who's worked on The Wire, someone who was there. You know, it's like someone who's actually seen the Ramones play live or whatever you want to say. So I was like, what? And so she put us in touch. But that's probably why we had that contact, is because DS106 has become a class that's very DIY, but it's all about showing people how to do visual design, audio, video, etc. Just experiment with these different forms on the web through a class. And in 2011, when we went open, Grant Potter, who was living in British Columbia, created a radio station for us. And that's what we're on right now, is DS106 Radio. So it's a lot of futzing and menacing. So that's context for who we are and what we do. And if you want, please introduce yourself, maybe a little bit about what you do, and we'll get into this.
Okay. Well, my name is Jen Ralston, and I went to New York University Film School. I gravitated towards sound while I was in the program, and started working as a sound editor immediately after graduation. I've been working for about 20 years now, mostly features, though I did have the opportunity to work on an HBO pilot I don't even know the math anymore. What is it, like 12, 13 years ago, I guess? And
12, yeah.
That became The Wire, and I've been working for that executive producer, David Simon, ever since. So I did all of The Wire. I worked on Generation Kill, which was the miniseries he did as a follow-up, and then I was the supervising sound editor for Treme, which was the next series he did. And I'll be working with him again next spring on a new miniseries that he's doing for HBO.
Wow, cool. So you also worked on Treme.
Yeah, I worked on Treme as the supervising sound editor, and I also was fortunate enough to write half of one of the episodes in season 3.
That is awesome.
Nice.
Yeah. Wow. So you're bona fide, as they would say.
Ready? Yeah.
So I also saw, and I know this is a sidetrack, and you probably get annoyed by people like me asking you, I also saw you worked on The Big Lebowski.
I did. That was, yeah.
How was that? Was that fun?
It was awesome. I loved working with the Coen brothers. I worked on 3 movies that they did. Big Lebowski was the first, and then Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and then The Man Who Wasn't There, I guess, was the last one that I worked on. And they're just great to work with because they appreciate sound, and they know what sound can do to enhance and help them tell their stories. So they have a respect for the sound crew. Which translates into things like taking us out to steak dinners when the mix is done and giving us cool little gifts like that from time to time. So
that's cool you did Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, because I was quoting that when I said you're bona fide.
Yeah.
And you probably knew that because you heard that a million times.
Sure, I don't even like most of my day-to-day conversational catchphrases are from movies that I worked on or TV shows, and I just don't even know where they come from anymore. Because, you know, by the time you're done working on a movie, you've seen it about 90 times, and it's just in there. If he'd have said, you know, we thought you was a toad, I know that was from... Yeah, now that you say it, yeah, bona fide, yeah.
That's awesome. So, couple of things about, you know, because we're dealing with people who are going to probably experience audio for the first time, many of the students at Mary Washington. And just out of interest, you went to school at NYU to film school. How did you get into actually the sound? Why the sound? What drew you to it? And what would you say to someone who actually finds that connection this semester? And what did you do afterwards, if that makes any sense?
Well, I would say if somebody actually finds the connection, congratulations. I can't honestly say that I found the connection. It kind of found me logistically because, I had a bit of a sound background because I grew up in a small town with Kristen and Cole. We didn't have a local TV station or certainly any film production companies. And I knew that I wanted to be involved in film production in some capacity. So when I started taking internships in high school, I gravitated towards the local radio station and the local theater ensemble. But I did the radio station first. So since I knew how to work a soundboard, the theater ensemble said, oh, great, you know how to work a soundboard. And I did sound for them. And then when I got to film school, everybody was like, oh, wow, you know how to do this stuff. And they just kept kind of throwing it at me. And I didn't have an objection to it because it is an interesting, you know, aspect of storytelling. It's kind of underappreciated, but it's very important. And at the same time, because it's underappreciated, cynically, I have to say, nobody was willing to do it for free. So I was the only student who was getting paid to work on student films. So I thought sound was pretty cool. Because, you know, if you write, you direct, you operate a camera, all of those things, everybody was kind of lining up to take their turn to do. But to do sound, they would pay you to do it because nobody wanted to or really knew how. So that's how I started with it, but really came to appreciate it as a method of storytelling and a way to kind of enhance. I mean, I still write and I make my own little projects on the side, and it's not the be all and end all of my creative outlets, but as a career goes, it's a pretty good one and it's rewarding.
Well, you're also starting to see the transformation of that with the writing of the Treme episode.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was a great opportunity, and I hope there'll be more.
What episode was it, just out of interest? Because I watched that show through with my wife Antonella, and I'll go back and watch it. I'm fired up now.
It was season 3, episode 5. It was the Christmas episode of season 3. Storyline wise, it was the Isabella Rossellini episode.
Oh, really? Oh, that's awesome. Well, congratulations. That's cool as hell.
Thank you.
So we brought you here to talk about The Wire a little bit, and we do have some clips lined up to talk about. But before I start that, Paul, I didn't want to kind of step on anything that you wanted to say.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, that's fine. I'm just really fascinated by the use of sound and storytelling. It's something I really hadn't paid attention to before, I don't think. Although I knew, as you said, it's underappreciated. You know, I think it's really powerful, but people don't give it the kind of conscious attention they pay to the visual.
Right.
But going back and listening to The Wire this time, I'm like listening to it with headphones really closely into the things that are going on in there. And it's really fascinating how that's all comes together.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of the experience we had just watching The Wire again for the second or third time, is all of the little details that emerge when you're not watching it for the complex storyline that's going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
it's a complicated storyline for sure, yeah.
But you put on the headphones and you realize, wait, it's a complicated storyline, and then there's a complicated visual dynamic, audio dynamic, you know, kind of filmic dynamic going on that you also can watch. You can watch the show 10 times and still be reading into the layers of it.
Yeah, no, totally true. I mean, I had that experience myself. I would get the scripts and I would read them. And that was, I think I was kind of luckier than most people viewing it because I got to have my my storyline reading literally without the distraction of the picture or the sound. I got to just read the script and find out what was happening. And then we would get picture. It usually wasn't a locked version of picture when we started working, or at least the first time we saw it, and we would go through it. I would go through it with David Simon, usually also the whoever was the picture editor for that episode, and we would just go through it scene by scene, and we would have discussions about everything. So anything that wasn't clear to me needed to be made clear to me so that we could decide how much of it needs to be clear to the audience and how we were going to do that, if there was a way for the sound to do it, or if it wasn't important for the audience, you know, like, some of the dialogue isn't necessarily intelligible in some of the recording instances or the accent issues. And it's like, well, do we chase that? Do we want to make Snoop more intelligible? No, we don't.
Yeah.
You know, you get the point watching the scene. And if you understand what she's actually saying, you must live in Baltimore, first of all. And second of all, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't detract if you don't. So to, you know, kind of whatever dumb down her accent for the rest of the country would do a disservice to the character. And, you know, but we'd had those discussions about everything. We didn't always reach conclusions that I agreed with, but we talked about pretty much everything.
And it's also this nature in the show seemingly of the documentary appeal, right? Like all the sounds are seemingly cited and sourced, mm-hmm. and you know where they're coming from. And I was wondering just quickly, like, what was your experience actually? Did you go out and create sounds? This was all after it was filmed. Like, how was your experience seeing and building for The Wire? Obviously, you probably weren't on the set in Baltimore, or were you?
I wasn't on set very often. My sound crew was in New York City. And production was down in Baltimore. And so I was the only member of the sound crew who was traveling between the two places. I would go down to Baltimore to have meetings with David and to record ADR and loop group. I don't know if your class is familiar with those aspects of sound yet, but that's when the actors come into the studio and redo their dialogue afterwards for accent issues or recording quality, or to add, mostly for David's stuff, to add lines. He never stops writing. So I was in charge of all of those sessions, and he was usually on set when we had meetings about starting each episode. So I would go down and talk to him. I was on set a few times when they were actually shooting, mostly in season one. I saw the orange couch. I was at that set. I was there on Wallace's last day of shooting, which was pretty sad. But I can't really say I remember too many other specific details about being on set. It wasn't the priority for me. I was just kind of waiting for them to finish doing that so we could have our meetings.
Sure.
So the process was mostly, there was a lot of library stuff. I mean, I don't know how to say, you know, when they recorded on location, because they recorded on location, there weren't too many actual sets, and they were in Baltimore and recording in real places that were open for business, or, you know, that they didn't really have control over the sound quality. So there's a lot of sound in the show that we couldn't really replace, or we could if we spent the time, but we decided that it wasn't worth it. Because of that documentary kind of feeling that David was going for, and the kind of giving the impression that it wasn't, it wasn't The Sopranos. It wasn't some like slick production with camera tracking dolly shots and stuff like that. Everything is a pretty static camera, and you just kind of feel like you're a fly on the wall and it's really happening. So whenever the sound was busy in a bad way, it wasn't necessarily bad for us, unless it really detracted from the storyline. But we did add things. I took a little recorder down with me when I had those trips to Baltimore, and I recorded backgrounds. And I remember we sent our sound effects team, all two of them, to Baltimore for season two to record a lot of things on the docks to get all of the all the equipment and stuff that happens in the port storyline, all that heavy machinery and stuff. But yeah, did I answer your question?
You did. I mean, what's interesting just hearing you say it is, I mean, the way in which, as much as you want to create the documentary feel, you've got to get rid of a lot of what's originally on the recording, right, and pare it down and then build it back up. So in fact, it's some way even more fictional in its documentary appeal. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, you know, every time we had a scene that was on location and the noise was dirty, it wasn't necessarily a conversation that we had consciously or that I had with David every time, but looking at the scenes, you have to say, this is a noisy location. Are we supposed to believe it's a noisy location? Yes. Is it so noisy that it's distracting from the dialogue? If yes, then which parts are distracting and how can we fix them? And if not, then not necessarily just go with it, but oddly enough, in a lot of ways, the easiest solution when you're dealing with a scene that's too noisy is to add more noise. Just because what you're dealing with is when you shoot a scene, you're shooting from several different angles, different times of the day, right? So you've got two people in a courtyard and they're talking, and on Stringer Bell's side, you see traffic behind him. Well, the microphone's going to be pointing at the actor. It's going to be picking up that traffic. But on the other side, D'Angelo, there's no traffic behind him. So you're not hearing the traffic on his side. It's a noisy scene overall, but the problem isn't the noise. The problem is that the noise keeps coming and going.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when one actor's talking, it's noisy. When the other actor's talking, it's not noisy. So the solution is to either spend the time to remove the sound from the noisy side, which isn't necessarily a thing you wanted. I mean, we're seeing traffic. Why wouldn't we hear it?
Yeah.
So you've just got to find more traffic to put on the other side of the conversation and just make it consistent.
Do you use like one piece of sound as like the source sound to say, okay, this is what's going on in the background. We need to keep this consistent throughout the entire scene.
No, not necessarily. It's a hard thing for me to try to describe because it's just like at this point it was just something that we were doing out of necessity and kind of running on instinct. I studied documentary when I was at NYU. That was my focus. I mean, I did sound for other people's projects, but my area of concentration was documentary. And I think the difference between what we were doing with The Wire and what a lot of narrative projects do. And this gets a little, I apologize, it's getting academic. Well, it's, yeah.
That's good.
But, you know, usually what narrative sound is trying to do is it's trying to tell the story as clearly as possible. So, like, if you watch a regular TV show, especially these days, the more current the show, the more you're going to see instances of this. When people are talking, you don't get a lot of perspective on the voices. Even if the camera's really far away, they sound like they're right here. And that's because as technology improves, wireless, small wireless mics, the quality of that recording gets better. And, you know, it used to be we had these location microphones, these, you know, shotgun booms that were very directional. But they also got a sense of the space that the scene was being shot in. And because they were so big and the actors weren't wearing them, they could only be as close as the camera let them. So if you had a wide shot, you know, the microphone would be up here just out of frame. And the closer the camera got, the closer the mic could get, right? So you always had a sense of the space between the camera and the action, and it was sort of framing for the audience how far away they were from the action. And the way TV specifically is done now is everybody just wears their little microphone, and no matter where they are in the scene, you can hear them as if they're right up in your face. And things do get mixed for perspective sometimes, but there's a falseness to it. You know, it just kind of gets turned down or turned up, but you don't really get that sense. And what we always did with The Wire was we looked at a scene, and even though our actors did have those microphones on. We also usually had a boom to rely on. And we looked at the scene and we decided, how far away do we want to hold the audience back from this information? And where is the perspective for the sound going to be? And a lot of times, because it was surveillance work, you know, we're even when the cops weren't necessarily surveilling the hoppers, the scenes always started in a really, really far back shot because we were on the outside entering their world. And it's, to me, it was always very jarring to have a scene that started that far back, but to hear their voices like they were really far forward. So what we did was we just changed the perspective of people's dialogue based on how close the camera let them be. And it added to the surveillance feeling. It added to the documentary feeling. You know, we weren't trying to kind of flatten the depth of the audience's perception and make it as clear as possible all the time. We were holding them at the same length that the camera was holding them, if that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense. And it reminds me of one of the directors. I think it was Wesley Clark, but I might be wrong with the name there. Vince Clark?
No? Clark Johnson.
Clark Johnson. Thanks. Yeah. He talked about the conversation as being a kind of influence. And thinking about that and then thinking about how Coppola used sound and surveillance and the idea of the digital trying to put this stuff together, did that play in, speaking of academic, to like some of the ways have you kind of thought about surveillance and the use of sound in this series at all?
Well, I mean, you know, the conversation for any sound geek was an important film, and I can't say that I watched it a lot of times before we did The Wire, but for certain, the first episode, we paid a direct homage to it when McNulty and Bunk go to visit the I can't remember his name anymore, but the FBI guy, Fitzhugh.
Right. Yeah, Fitzhugh, that's right.
When they go to visit Fitzhugh, and they've got Fitzhugh showing them, he has the pinhole camera, and they're listening to these guys bag drugs. The quality of the sound of the wiretap that the FBI were running, we worked very hard to try to replicate what the sound around the fountain in the conversation sounded like as Harry Call was kind of tuning them in and out from different microphones. You know, there's not just a perspective shift, but there was this this kind of digital fuzz that came and went and had a musicality to it. And we were trying to process that stuff the same way. And it was a reference to the conversation for sure.
That's brilliant. And it also reminds me in episode 5, season 1, when Avon Barksdale is paranoid and looking around. And I got that sense of, you know, Henry Call at the end of the conversation. And the conversation just themically, you know, really does, as many of the 70s New York City cop films, like Prince of the City, Serpico, you know, there seemed to be this very Sidney Lumet parallel with what David Simon's doing. But particularly in the sound and in the surveillance shots, I was kind of struck by it. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I love that you were citing the conversation. I mean, I'm sure for a sound geek, that's nothing. But for me, it's exciting to hear that that's actually it. So,
oh, Walter Murch is.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's awesome.
I was fortunate enough to hear him speak recently. I work up at Skywalker now, the George Lucas facility. And he did a talk for a bunch of Sundance filmmakers who came in for a workshop, and I got to hear him talk for like 2 hours, and he's brilliant. He's just a brilliant guy. Wow. About everything ever, like not just sound, not just picture, like the natural sciences, economics, like anything. He just knows about everything.
He's a Renaissance man who got spun up into sound somehow. That's awesome. So speaking of sound in The Wire, we talked about sharing a couple of clips. I just wanted to run this by you and see if they work through the internet. So these are clips. We're going to play three real quick. We're going to play The Wire, Front and Follow, when Jimmy and has his sons following Stringer Bell throughout that Baltimore market. And is that one you would mind just listening to and then telling us a little bit about your thinking? Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm going to try this right now. And hopefully this streams out over the radio. So here we go. You guys hear that?
18.
Oh. You don't.
I hear it.
Okay, let's see.
All right, this one's for Mikey.
Okay, I'm hearing it.
Okay. You want me to put it up a little bit?
Yeah.
You ready?
Okay.
Number 6. I know it. Sean, shush.
David, Siggy.
Melvin, Mora, numbnuts.
I thought Mora was number 9.
Listen, guys, we're going to play that spy game. Do you remember the spy game?
Yeah.
Who's it?
The tall black guy over there.
You're supposed to say African-American.
African-American.
I'm the front, you're the follow.
I was the follow last time.
Don't worry, keep going. Go.
Yeah, they're both brown hair, one that big, the other about that big, and he's wearing...
Yep.
Okay, I'm back. So we can turn that one off at that point. So what do you think of that? I know what you think of it, but what should we think of it?
Well, I think that the things to listen to are the contrast of in the market and out of the market, and who we're with when they're out of the market, kind of dictating what the sound is, ignoring for a second the music cue, which there are so few music cues in The Wire. I know it's hard to ignore any of them, but, you know, when we're in the market, it's a very realistic sound. There, having been in that market and many markets like it in the Baltimore area, it's, you know, this indoor space with cement floors and a lot of people, and it's just sort of a cacophony of voices, and nothing is particularly standing out. And not having the picture in front of me, I'm not sure this is true, but I think even when we're with McNulty and we're watching Stringer buy his fruit, we're not hearing the details of that purchase, correct?
No.
It just continues the montage of the noise of the market.
That's right.
It isn't until they go outside that you get a kind of a focused sound. And when the boys are outside, it's a very calm market. And it's so quiet. And this is the thing about when you're doing sound, and you're trying to tell a story. If you want something to sound quiet, turning the sound off is not the way to achieve that. That just makes people think there's something wrong. If they can hear their own world and they're not listening to the show anymore, then they think something's wrong. So you don't convey silence by making things quieter. You convey silence by bringing out details that you couldn't hear unless it was really quiet. Huh. So, you know, if we were to continue the sound and treat it the way we did inside the market, then outside the market, the traffic would be really noisy. You wouldn't be able to hear, maybe you would hear Stringer's car start up and drive away, but not that loudly, not that focused. And you wouldn't, you know, be able to hear all those little details, the boy's footsteps and the newspaper rustling and even, you know, you're hearing individual conversations outside the market there. And then, of course, when we're with McNulty, it's a completely different sound for him outside the market because it's this chaos of and panic of trying to find his kids. And so things are a lot louder in a more directed and justified way because of the interaction with the other car and the honking and stuff. But, you know, just cutting in between those two scenes, you would think, or the two perspectives outside the market between McNulty and the boys, you'd think that they were blocks away from each other when, you know, if anything, they are a block away from each other and it just sounds completely different to each of them.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because it's another example in the show and in the work you're doing in your art that you're reinforcing the theme or the moment, but not through kind of, you know, explosion-like music, like, da-da, where are the kids? But through subtle kind of elements of, you know, silence and you know, chaos through sound. It's interesting. I mean, the way in which that reinforces the themes that are happening.
Yeah, right. And also I do like that scene because of the music cue, because it was a thing that always made us laugh. And David chose that song specifically because he doesn't like music cueing people emotionally. And he had always said that he doesn't, you know, that musical soundtracks are to him like a cheat to say, okay, now we're happy or now we're concerned or now, you know, now it's suspenseful. And he said something to the effect of he liked that song because in real life, your soundtrack is never playing what you want it to play in the moment. You know, McNulty's going through this extreme crisis. I mean, he did a really dumb thing and he could lose his kids. And even if he finds his kids, if his kids tell his ex-wife, he could still lose his kids. And this is the song that's playing at that moment. It's not helping him.
And it also reinforces to me, you know, Richard Price called this, right? Am I wrong with that again? The Russian novel of TV shows. And it really works on a Dostoevsky-like level when you have all these details down to the sound and the song when he gets in the car and the panic. It's like, you know, it's been fun rewatching it just to see, like, and to speak to you to see, like, how deep this thinking goes and how much artistry went into every single level of it is really powerful. So, cool. Let's listen to the next one. And this one is going to be... Could you hear that all right? How was the sound on that for you? Could you kind of hear it?
I could hear it. When it got louder, I got a little bit of a reverb thing happening, or a little bounce back.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try and keep it together on DS106 Radio. This is high-quality stuff. You're in the lap of luxury right here. I know the green room didn't have enough red M&Ms, but we're gonna make up to you with that right now. This is Little Man and Wee Bay. And this is when Griggs gets shot. So, yeah, okay, let's go. Pretty sure this is it. Wait a minute. Yeah.
Stay loose. Gregory begging me, stop. Hers is what you say to me, but that's supposed to mean something. You know, when I seen frontin' in the club, you act, I don't buy it. I got the dub. Shit, it's too loud. Come on, everybody. Come on, just show your love. Come on, everybody.
any unit have the eyeball?
Negative 1135.
Come on, Rex. Tell us where the fuck you are.
Those in orbit refuse to forfeit. They all form a cipher and they came to absorb it. I follow suit and face it. It break.
Don't fuck with the scout. I'll be right back with your shit.
Where are we? That sign said Longwood, but I could swear this is Warwick.
Hoppers be turning the signposts to fuck with y'all.
I make it we're on the north side of Warwick. In an alley, I don't know shit. Half a block west of Longwood, maybe?
I hope y'all caught me then.
Yeah, that puts us about 8 blocks away. Pushing in a little closer.
All units be advised, Warwick near Longwood, in the north side alley, or near that 20.
He's got the right feel for you.
You creeping close? Long, because see, I don't know where the stash is, and if they're dragging us all over this part of town, you know.
What's that?
What?
Something ain't right.
What?
Shit ain't right.
Snitch!
No! Signal 13! Signal 13!
Gunshots!
Gunshots! Show citywide!
1135!
1135! Signal 13, Warren!
Near Longwood, officer down! Signal 13, Warwick near Longwood, in the alleys. Check the alleys, check the alleys.
North side, 2800 block, nothing.
We got an officer down, she's a number one, female, undercover.
833, we're on the side of 3100 block of Baker, clear.
2900 is dark. Foxtrot.
What are we looking for?
1135 to KGA. We can't find the officer down. We need Foxtrot. Looking for a green Lincoln Town car with a brown vinyl roof. It's parked in those alleys.
Foxtrot en route. 3814.
314.
Be advised, there's a single 13. 7820. Rear outside. 3300 block of Baker. Clear. Visual. Rear even side of Warwick and Longwood.
Okay, I'll stop it there. That's exactly when you actually come and you see them pulling up to Kima and what had happened. So that's an intense scene.
What yeah, was it took a like? Long time, as I recall. That was difficult.
That's amazing. So
yeah.
Also just the different levels it works on. So when you put that scene together, and very different from the final scene we'll talk about, which happens at the beginning of this episode, the scene with Bubbles. But in this scene, I mean, there's a climax of darkness. And so how are you building that with the soundscape?
Well, I mean, the action is mostly dictating that. But the thing is, you know, the tricky thing is it might be hard to imagine doing it any other way based on what picture we were being given. But I think it's very easy to imagine what this would have looked like if this was an episode of Criminal Minds or NCIS or, you know, any of the other police procedurals. You know, there'd be more looking at the radio while we're listening to somebody talk through the radio, and more establishing where the music is coming from before it disappears, and, you know, just kind of more visual cues to give you a sense of where things are coming and going. And I think that when you have those kind of visual cues, it kind of it gives It gives the listener a license to kind of hear everything loud, because it's like, well, oh, so the music's coming from that car. Okay. Well, as long as we're looking at and we're inside the car with them and it's really loud, then when we cut to the outside of the car, we're going to stay with them. But doing that kind of aligns the audience with whoever's in the car, whoever's listening to the music. And the one thing that we were constantly doing is, because we were matching the perspectives of the camera, we weren't taking sides. You know, we weren't with Kima when it happened. We were with the confusion trying to find Kima when it happened. And the one thing that I'm really proud of in that sequence is, while we never see KGA, or we never see the person who's operating the helicopter, who is Foxtrot, and we never see, you know, we never see the operator on just a regular police van, the difference in the quality of all of the sounds in the radio indicate to you who's talking and what they can hear, right? So because we've set it up in a scenario, because picture and because the script has set it up in a scenario where we're with Daniels and McNulty and Greggs and, you know, everybody else in the unit, and we're hearing what they hear through Kima's microphone and communicate to each other through their handsets, we know what they can hear. And so when all of a sudden something goes down and they need to call like the wide band radio and use the radio that's attached to their cars and not just their little walkie-talkies, you hear the difference, and it's actually still clear while they're having multiple conversations. They're talking to each other, I've checked this alley, and they're getting information from the operator and the 1013 signal call and, you know, other units responding to that. It all remains clear. And it was, that was the difficult thing, was trying to time out the actions that we're seeing of the cars going through the alleys and what they, you know, what they're doing, and trying to give them their sounds, and at the same time have these other details coming through.
Well, what I think is amazing just watching it is, I mean, the way in which the drama of what we see with Kima come through in that digital broken way, and you kind of feel that, was like the sound itself is what's driving it. When you have the idea of Savino turn up the radio, and the idea that you're listening in and you want her to hear. And so it seems like a particular, like you're saying, a particular entire sequence that is the climax of the season, potentially, that's driven by this notion of sound. And there's those moments when it's a little bit calm, but it's really that calm before they come in and is something going on. And it's a scene that's replayed as only sound later on when they're in the hospital, right? And it's the only scene, I think, or one of the few scenes, there's actually a couple of others, that are replayed as a pure soundscape, right? Which is interesting, at least that scene with Kima. And were you thinking about that, knowing that you would have to, this would be one of the key elements of being told, not as a video, but as a sound to document if anyone did anything wrong, right?
Yeah, no, I can't say that I remember that was going to be one of the uses. I think it was one of the particular cares the writers took in putting all the radio stuff together.
Yeah.
Because I remember it was one of the few times that Ed Burns was on the stage with me. He was the co-executive producer with David Simon, and he was a cop. He was a cop who worked major case in Baltimore and homicide, and he was one of the subjects of David's writings for Homicide, A Year in the Killing Streets. And then they became writing partners when David decided to do A Year on a Drug Corner and wrote The Corner. He wrote it with Ed. Ed retired from the force and wrote it with him. And then, you know, a lot of the characters, a lot of the police stuff comes from Ed's personal experience. He went on to teach high school English or junior high school English. So he was sort of the Przybylowski reference. He's also the McNulty reference, because he was sort of the arrogant cop who wanted to take down the big drug dealers and was kind of the instrument that operated major crimes, or whatever version of major crimes really existed in Baltimore. But he wasn't really, he wrote he wrote the screenplays with David, but he wasn't really involved in the post-production process except for that scene. I remember him coming in, and we went, and that's an agonizing way to do it too, because when you're on an ADR stage, you're paying a lot of money per hour, and you want to be efficient, and you want to know what you're doing before you show up. But we sat there and we watched the scene over and over, and he hand wrote out what all the radio calls would be and when they need to be said, so that we understood, and everything fell into place. So it needed to make sense dramatically, and it also needed to make sense technically. And it took a long time to work that out.
Yeah, it's an amazing scene. I mean, is that one of the scenes in the series that you're most proud of just because of the complexity of it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it was one of the more difficult things, that and, the Bub scene that we're going to talk about. And also, Hamsterdam was really hard. You know, it's hard to get a whole bunch of people talking at once and get a sense of what they're saying and what they're doing, and kind of building that that open air drug market, and being able to hear every single product being touted and know and get the sense that, you know, everybody's on a different corner selling a different version of the same thing. It's not an easy thing to time out, and at the same time having it run in the background and not interfere with foreground dialogue. You know, there aren't a lot of big action things that happen in The Wire. The things that were really a challenge for the sound were that kind of stuff, you know, just kind of building those environments.
And to quote something you said earlier, which I found really fascinating, is this notion that not only you were sourcing stuff in the surrounding areas, you were making sure there was a perspective on it. So I read in one of the interviews you did about a boombox in the window. And you would actually, you know, be sure to understand how far away that was, how that would sound. So how do you go about making some of those calculations of sound? Like, is that just now your ear being so fine-tuned? Like, so how do you make some of those ideas of distance and perspective and a notion of, you know, that scape, if that makes any sense? Because I thought about it when you talked about Hamsterdam and all these different spaces and notion of space in relationship to time, to sound.
A lot of that comes in the mix, in the kind of our final couple of days with the sound. Our mixer was a guy named Andy Chris that I've worked with for a long time. And he's in New York. And, you know, in terms of the discussions of what the perspective was, that's one thing, but he's the one who really put the perspective on the things. You know, I would have those discussions with David sometimes in the spotting session, sometimes in the mix, where we would say, this seems too quiet, we need to add some music. And our music supervisor, Blake, would just kind of go through the list and, well, you know, we have all of these songs that we got rights to that could be played here, but that we haven't used yet. Which one do you want? And we, you know, would kind of pick one. David would mostly do the picking. And then the next question was, well, who's listening to it and how close are they to the action? It's like, well, you know, did one of the guys bring a boombox and we just don't see it? Or is it coming from one of the apartments, or, you know, a drive-by, a car driving by, or parked down the block? Like, where are we hearing it from? And making those decisions, we were just sort of going with, you know, as the scene progressed, because the answer could have been any one of those things, but the decision was usually predicated on how distracting would it be? How much would it add or subtract if it was this close versus that close? And, you know, it's like, we want a sense that the world is still turning here, but we don't want it to be so loud that it would actually be distracting the guys from doing their job. And like, that's not why they messed up the count, or that's not why they didn't hear what D'Angelo said. You know, we don't want it to be any confusion. They're just really bad at doing their jobs. It wasn't the music, you know? so that was usually what dictated how far away to put the music. And then just the technical act of placing the music there is something that happens in the mix with fancy equipment and, you know, adding reverbs and changing the EQ, changing the overall dynamic quality of a sound will trick the ear into believing that it's coming from a different perspective or further away or closer, stuff like that. The one thing I would say about that scene, the Greg shootout scene, is, you know, even the beginning of the scene, like I said with the front and follow, you're not silent at the beginning. but you're hearing details that you couldn't hear if it was a noisy area, right? So you're hearing a dog barking and you're hearing a baby cry. Yeah. And like, you know, not more music, not a different music, not a TV, not an argument. The decision was made to use a dog and a baby. And I can't honestly say I remember what the decision was, but listening to it now, and knowing what I usually was thinking when we were doing this stuff, is the dog I used a lot whenever somebody was kind of trespassing. If somebody was where they didn't belong, it would set the dogs barking. McNulty makes dogs bark wherever he goes, specifically when he's on booty calls, because he's a dog. So the other dogs know that and they respond to it.
That's awesome.
That was a decision that I made. You know, it's like, oh, here's McNulty. He's drunk and he's trying to get into Perlman's apartment again. The neighborhood dogs need to start barking. But, you know, the dogs would bark whenever. And because we didn't have music to hide behind, we were using these sound cues to kind of dictate what the emotion was going to be for a scene, right? So the idea that they're somewhere they shouldn't belong, then everybody, you know, the neighborhood knows it. The dogs can smell it. You know, there's somebody here who shouldn't be here. And the baby means a couple of things to me. And, you know, making decisions like this of what to hear in the background, it's not something that you ever really expect the audience to go, yeah, I understand what that means. But, you know, certain sounds evoke certain emotions. And when certain universalities like that come into play, you know you're safe. You're not going to misdirect anybody by using a sound like that. And for me, the baby, first of all, a baby crying that late at night says they're not in a good neighborhood. You know, if kids are not sleeping soundly when it's in the, you know, the middle of the night, this is not the suburbs, right? There's an element of danger. And also, for me, I remembered something David said early on, which is, in terms of the story structure for season one, Wallace and Greg's are the two innocents. There's one on each side. And so that's sort of a callback for me to that. You know, she's the babe in the woods, and this is, you know, possibly her demise. So
that is interesting, particularly because
there was a really fascinating thing that happened in there. As you hear the baby crying and the dogs barking, and you hear Wee Bay and Little Man coming up, you know, Greg says, "Oh, wait a minute, what's that?" And for a split second, everything went quiet. Uh-huh. Like the baby and the dog are looking too, you know.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
It's also awesome, the question of the baby and Griggs and Wallace as the two innocents. I never thought about that, but they're both left out to dry by their respective gangs, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's brilliant. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You're on a roll, Jen. Don't stop.
I think I was done rambling.
Do not stop. You're killing it right now.
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I wrote a couple of things down while we were listening to that scene, but I think I pretty much covered them all. Just the sense of, you know, the tension at the beginning with the baby and the dog. I wrote invasion and innocence. We covered that. And then just, yeah, hitting home with the music perspectives and the radio, who hears what, who has access to what information, and the decision that was made in the picture to not show the gunfire, I think, is an important decision. You know, I can't, sound can't take credit for that. We can only really follow picture most of the time, and either enhance or subvert what it's doing. But picture made the conscious decision to not let you be there when she gets shot. You know, you're stuck with McNulty trying to find the right sign, trying to find the right street post. And I think even from what I recall of that scene, when she's saying she can't read the street post and she can't tell, the picture doesn't do you the favor of showing you how the street post is turned in that moment. You can't see any street post. It's not like, oh, she's reading it and it's sideways. You don't get to see what she's seeing. You know, you get to see what we decide to show you.
It's interesting.
Just not an omniscient view.
It's interesting, too, because McNulty is in the same state of panic that he is when he lost his boys.
Right. And has the same inability to do what a cop is supposed to do and say what he couldn't tell you what those kids were wearing. He didn't know how tall they were.
That's right.
You know, and he has no idea where, you know, what alley his partner is in right now.
He's, absolutely.
In a lot of ways, he's not a very competent cop, according to these examples.
Well, one last question for you, and it's probably a non sequitur, so just say I have no idea, shut up, and we'll move on. But the helicopter. Mm-hmm. Does every helicopter scene done like this now, are they always sourcing John Carpenter's The Thing? I mean, that's all I can think of when I think of that movie is helicopters, and I love them.
You know what? I don't see The Thing when I see that helicopter shot. I see Call of Duty. But I think we might have been before the Call of Duty reference, and I think so. So then I guess it all comes down to what people at home watching the news saw of the Iraq War. You know, that's how we saw targets getting hit, was that kind of infrared black and white camera mounted to the bottom of a helicopter and seeing, you know, little black puffs of smoke. That's kind of how we equate reality from a helicopter view now, I guess.
Wow. This is amazing. Okay, so speaking of amazing, we are going to talk about the scene with Bubbles. Mm-hmm. And this is Bubbles at the beginning of, is this episode 10? Yeah, it's the same episode as Griggs getting shot. Mm-hmm. And this is the amazing opening scene of that episode with Bubbles, who's cleaned up and sober. So this is him in the park. And there's really just no, I think the only dialogue in the whole scene is, hey, Bubs. That's it. Okay, so here we go.
What's up, Bugs?
Hey.
Well, there you go.
Yo, what you got?
I got some stars.
And then you know what comes after that, right? Yeah. You've probably heard that song 50,000 times.
Something maybe. Like that.
So what do we make of Bubs in the beginning?
Yeah, what do we make of Bubs in the beginning? He's sober, and we've never seen him sober before. And we've certainly heard or been privy to the world that he's in. We hear the world that he lives in, but this is the first time he's lived in this particular world, and so things sound different, and we treated him in a way that's not unrealistic and not even not cinematic. It's just a way that we don't really treat sound on the wire normally, which is to say, I mean, you hear when he does this, you hear his cloth rustle, you hear the kids, there's just an overall sense of first of all, a sense of space. Normally we would play the backgrounds, that just the air tones and the general noise floor would be so much higher that it would kind of have a sense that something was pressing in on you because it's just so loud. And this scene doesn't have that. The air is kind of a more distant and subdued air. You can hear the wind in the trees. You can hear the church bell. You can hear traffic two blocks away, you know. And you hear those little details like the stroller and the bicycle spokes, which you do hear occasionally with the hoppers. They have some lookouts that are on bikes, but they're a lot louder now. And you can even hear the conversations of people that are walking by, which we hardly ever hear. And they're pleasant conversations. They're conversations about trying to get a babysitter and having a good job and,
yeah.
You know,
Making all that money, I think she said, right? Like he's making. Yeah,
that's the problem with making all that money. Now you need to get somebody to watch your kid. It's all just kind of. It was a special moment, so we treated it specially. And I want to say that credit music, we had several different versions of that to get us into, and we had several different versions of the end credit music to get us out of picture. And things changed based on the needs. And if you listen to that one, the opening credit music, there's a ramp up that starts several seconds before the song properly starts. So it kind of builds up under the air tones, under the backgrounds of that scene, and then becomes a song.
Huh. So it's actually subdued in that scene, and then it kind of builds up into it, or buried in it, maybe is a better term.
Yeah, it's buried in the beginning.
Well, can I ask you another question about that scene? Towards the end of it, mm-hmm. you know, there is this scene, and he's like, oh, Lord, and you're right, he's touching him. He's seeing the leaves and they're so bright. It almost looks like a Terrence Malick shot, right? Like from, you know, Thin Red Line or something. But then towards the end, he starts seeing the dealers and there's a kind of subtle undertone too of kind of, you know, I wouldn't say paranoia, but the sense that the urge is coming back. But it's super subtle, kind of like the roll into the credits. Was that actually intentional or am I just seeing that because I'm seeing the visual?
Well, I think a lot of that is the visual and the acting. Andre's just really, really good in that scene. But the one thing that does kind of play into that with the sound that we had a choice to do or not do is if you listen, there's one little drug tout towards the end, and the product that they're selling is stars. And then the very next shot, Bubs tries to like kind of block them out, and what he looks at, the little boy is playing with a bubble wand, and it's a star.
Well, interestingly too, I mean, there's got to be a play there with they have bubbles, right? Like they are blowing bubbles. It seemed too much of a layup, but there is that too. It's his scene, right?
Yeah, all the different meanings of how bubbles could be a fun and playful thing, and exactly. How they could not be.
Okay, so I want to thank you, Jen, for taking us through this and for all your time and effort. But I would ask you on the way out, and Paul, throw in anything else, you know, how would you talk about, like, as you're talking about making stories with sound, which now you do and you make a living at it and you're pretty exceptional at it. And I love the way not only you obviously do imply your trade, but the way you think about it critically and analytically, and almost literary in some ways. So any advice for some storytellers that are going to be kind of burgeoning here in DS-106 of ways to think about telling stories through audio? It's probably a million, I know. So feel free to give us the short story of it.
I would just say, you know, don't think about trying to repeat things you've already seen and heard. Just try to... I think it's always an important tool. Sound is an important tool when you're trying to get the audience to relate to a character. And if you do that in subtle ways, as opposed to with picture, like picture can't really be that subtle. If you want the audience to see something and you want the audience to know that the character saw it, the camera has to show the character looking at the thing and then cut to the thing. And that's how an audience goes, oh, okay, I saw it, and he saw it, and we know that he saw it, and now we're supposed to know that he's acting as a result of seeing it. You don't have to do that with sound. Sound, and this is a Walter Murch thing, picture, every time you blink, you're making a new frame. And picture blinks 24 times a second. Sound never blinks. Sound is a continuum, and things can come in and out of your hearing, of your conscious hearing, of your, you know, can be audible or not audible, and having it there and not having it there can do so much more than just focusing on a thing with picture and then not focusing on that thing with picture. You know, you can have things. I was working with a young filmmaker recently through the Sundance Lab, and she's still working on her script, and she did a few sample scenes, and we were working on them just to discuss what sound design and what musical composition can do in terms of storytelling. And she was saying that one of the problems she was having with her script was trying to get across the point that her character, her main character, her protagonist, was distrustful of men. You know, she had been in a foster home. She had been in and out of the juvenile system. She had to turn to prostitution to eat, and she was afraid of men. She didn't like men. And how many ways in which she could do that without it being this overhanded, heavy-handed thing. And I said, maybe just as simple as you could write a scene, or you might already have a scene where she's walking down the street and there's somebody across the street, and like what she can hear of their conversation kind of dictates how in tune she is to her environment. So, to compare, like, she feels like an outsider if the people across the street are kids and they're laughing and having fun. She can't hear them. There's a rift between her and them. There's traffic or a siren or something, and you can just hear little bits of laughter, like it's kind of out of her reach. And but then, if she's somewhere else, you might not even see a man. But if you heard a man yelling, like there's some violence happening, some male aggression happening somewhere, and she could just kind of stiffen up. You don't need to have a scene where she's sitting with a counselor and saying, well, here's my problem, and here I'm going to explain it to you and to the audience, because, this is how we tell stories with picture. You can do a lot of things with sound that you don't need to, like, insult the audience by stopping and doing that with.
Yeah, and it seems that that's exactly a lot of what The Wire is constantly doing, right? Mm-hmm. Using all its, abilities, using all the media at its disposal, to not insult, but to actually heighten the experience to, really another level for TV. And that's constantly, it's why awesome just to hear you read those three scenes and kind of reinforce what we've been talking about as a class. To hear you articulate that so beautifully really kind of gets me excited to now go back and watch it all again, this time with no picture, right? it's awesome. So.
Along to Generation Kill, there's a lot more happening there, too.
Is that right? Yeah, because Treme was awesome. I watched Treme. I didn't see Generation Kill, but I read in that article that that's the thing he did right after The Wire.
Yeah, Generation Kill was even, I think, in a lot of ways more challenging than The Wire sonically, because there was no music. There was the decision was made by David that, when First Recon Marines are in combat situations, they can't listen to music. You can't have those distractions. And in that case, we weren't, Generation Kill isn't an omniscient view. It's more of a, here's what it's like to be a grunt, boots on the ground, kind of a soldier in a modern war. And so in order to kind of align the audience with those characters, the decision was made, well, if they can't hear music, neither can we. Huh. So the only times you hear music in Generation Kill are when they're singing to each other. They sing to amuse themselves. So you
don't have to deal with the musical cues at all. It's actually part of the whole tapestry of the show.
Yeah. And also, there is some war stuff that happens, there's some explosions and stuff, but we didn't treat it like filmic war movies. We had military advisors who were actually, some of them were the actual Marines that the series was about. It was based on a series of articles that were written for the Rolling Stone by a journalist named Evan Wright, and then turned into a book, and then the book was adapted into this miniseries by David and Ed. So these are real guys that the story is about, and some of these real guys were sitting there with me and with the sound mixers and saying, no, that's not what a 50 cal sounds like. And no, when a bomb lands that far away from you, that it doesn't sound that cool. It sounds, more like this, and making us make it less movie and more real. But the action in the miniseries is minimal compared to the amount of time that's just kind of spent waiting for something to happen, sort of like The Wire and Police Work. And so the levels of conversations that are happening over the radios and off camera, because you only have like 25 guys in this unit. So you don't get you don't get babies crying, you don't get dogs barking, you don't get, you know, neighbors outside yelling at their kids. You only have those 25 voices to work with, and they're constantly going. They're just constantly talking.
That sounds amazing. Was that a more complicated in some ways for you series to actually edit than The Wire?
It was. Most of the crew, most of the sound crew for Generation Kill was English. The miniseries went into production before The Wire ended. In fact, I think as early as season 4, David was flying to South Africa for shoots and coming back really cranky and jet lagged. And I kept saying to him, you know, I really want to work on this. And he's like, oh, it'll be done by the time The Wire's over. And it was just such a complicated shoot and went so far beyond schedule that by the time The Wire ended, they actually had just begun sound work. But they had already thinking that it was going to be a bad overlap. They had already hired a crew in England. And so everybody else on the show, except for me, was English in the sound department and had never seen The Wire. The Wire hadn't come to TV there yet. And they were constantly fighting David and I on the aesthetics of it, trying to make it sound like what they thought a war movie should sound like, and didn't know who these Americans were that were trying to tell them to make it sound worse and less interesting. But the one thing I do remember is I had a coworker. I was dealing specifically with the ADR and the loop group for that series, and having to fly to South Africa and fly to London and, you know, LA, New York, just constantly going from session to session. And so I had a co-ADR supervisor for every episode, because I was the person who was actually in the room with the actors. There needed to be somebody else just organizing all the recordings that were coming and editing them. And my co-ADR supervisor for most of the series was a guy named Nigel Stone, who worked on the Lord of the Rings movies. And I remember him telling me at one point, when he saw the ADR list for episode 1 of Generation Kill, which is an hour long, he said that there was more ADR in it than in the first Lord of the Rings movie. So he was like, so you know, you just tell me what it is you want me to do, and I will stay out of your way, because... like, we had a crew of 8, and you're doing this all by yourself, so whatever you say. It was a lot of work.
Was it? Yeah. Was it the best work you think you've done, though, in terms of just, you know?
It was the best ADR and loop group work I've ever done. Yeah. We didn't have real actors for the background for the loop group either. We used the actual Marines, so which we did a lot on The Wire, too. We didn't have a lot of professional actors in the smaller roles or in the background voice roles. We had a lot of just local, Baltimore locals who had really good accents. A lot of people who did background voices for The Wire were the subject of The Corner, of the book and the miniseries that David and Ed wrote, The Corner, which was about drug dealers and drug addicts. So my day-to-day in Baltimore was working with some people who used to sell or use a lot of drugs. But if they cleaned up and survived that phase of their life, then chances are they ended up in my loop group for The Wire. So all those voices in the background that are having arguments or, you know, selling drugs, they probably have firsthand experience of what that's supposed to sound like. But I didn't have to deal with a lot of actors. And that is... and I prefer it, but it is challenging when you're in a studio and you're trying to get a dramatic performance out of somebody who doesn't have any training and doesn't necessarily have any interest in advancing in that field.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Jen, again, I can't thank you enough. I mean, this is gold. This is going to be not only are the people listening on DS106 Radio now, but also that this is going to be a broadcast that I'll share with you, but an archive for the class to listen to as they start to go into audio. So again, right. Thank you for everything. You rule, really, absolutely. I'm serious.
All right.
Yeah, this was really awesome.
It was amazing.
Thanks for caring about sound.
We do. We think you rule.
Right.
And Generation Kill is next on the list now.
Before, man. It's a good series.
Awesome. Thanks, Jen.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye, DS106 Radio. For life! Awesome. That was awesome.
Yeah.
She is amazing. I am so fired up we captured all that. Okay, my wife is screaming at me downstairs. She's pissed because I was supposed to be done at 6:15. That said, this was worth every minute over. DS106 Radio, Paul, I'll share this for you when you get it. Anyone out there who's listening, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. That was radio gold, as they say. Okay, Paul, I'm out.
All right. Later.
Later.